Well, that stunned you all into silence. Do I see any hands? I can go home. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yes, at the back.
Is the real personal income, average personal income, more than real GDP per person or less?
Is real personal income more than GDP? You mean...
Real
GDP per head. Are you talking about now or in a socialist society?
No, in capitalism.
Well, I would have thought in capitalism, because GDP per head is an average, there will be plenty of people who will have real income below the GDP per head.
No, I don't mean this. I mean both are average. We take average for both. For real income per person and GDP.
Or average real income, is that less? I would have thought well, I don't have the stats in front of me, so I'm not going to speculate, I'm afraid. And that's not part of the topic of the talk, so I haven't prepared any answer on that one. Yes, at the back.
At one point you said that we could have these shadow prices, of course, something else. What would be the common unit which they would be expressed or calculated?
That's a good question. I think the common unit that Kantarovich seemed to be using is labour time. So it could well be done with labour time accounting. Although I think actually if you look realistically, it could be anything. It could even be made up prices from a previous... We could set... As long as through the system or through whichever way you work it, you're consistent in using the prices, it would turn into a realistic price between them. So you could set arbitrary prices for certain inputs and still come out with rational choices between those prices in meeting the targets. But certainly for Kantarovich, but then again, that part of that... was he was having to pay lip service to formal Soviet dogma. So there's even a wonderful... his book on use of economic resources has an introductory paragraph, chapter by the head of the Moscow Institute or wherever it was he was working at the time, saying, yeah, this is theoretically unsound, but we're publishing it anyway because it's interesting. And so clearly he had some support from his superiors to be off message in a totalitarian regime. But I think there was an element of... Certainly there's a guy called Paul Cockshott, you can find his stuff online, who wants to have labour time vouchers, and he thinks that Kantarovich can be used in the context of a labour time voucher economy. But I would think that the point, from what I've read, the point is it could be any, as long as it's objectively determined that these are the input prices and this is the outcomes between the various production methods, as long as you're consistent. But certainly for him it was pricing and I think labour value. But
if you use labour time, and you get the same results that you do under capitalism, the same pressures to reduce labour time to a minimum, to reduce monetary cost.
Yes, you would. You would certainly. Well, if your aim is to get the most efficient, because obviously the point of what he was doing was saying this is how we meet our planning targets. So he's assuming the plan is given. This has been set by central government fiat. This is how to match the plan to available resources and make the outcomes work. And yes, he was working in a plywood firm, so obviously the idea was to reduce costs at the firm level of a plywood firm. But I don't think necessarily that you would end up being exactly like capitalism, because obviously you don't have to have... If you're just using it to say, well, that one is the cheapest method, you don't actually have to then make the profit afterwards. You don't have to have the return of getting tokens back. You just have to say, well, look, we've done the maths. This one would produce it would be the lowest price if we were in capitalism, therefore we can use this. So that is one possible mechanism we could use, or that could be used, rather. Obviously, part of the problem, one of the problems I have personally dealing with the economic calculation argument is that very much we are arguing from different premises. So, the one thing that they take completely for granted is the idea that you want to infinitely improve efficiency, so that you want to always try and find absolutely the most efficient way of doing absolutely everything, and as you say, sparing labour. Whereas I would say we argue as socialists that actually what we want to do is we want to achieve a given set of ends, and as long as those ends are achieved, it doesn't matter if technically we do it in what they would call an inefficient way, as long as they are attained. But that kind of means that you end up arguing past them, and I think that there is a way of, part of the point of this is disabling the talk, disabling the argument without arguing past, because otherwise they think that you're avoiding. And of course, what any sensible person in a debate does, if you find a point that your opponent can't answer, you cling on to it and you keep dragging them back to it time and time again. And you say, well, there's no further debate until you've answered this. So we need to have some way of saying, well, actually, okay, even on your own terms, we could have this efficiency measure, this efficiency measure. We can deal with all of these things. If we then choose to just throw labour at the job and get it done, then that's so much the better. But I mean, the only thing we need to avoid is, as I was trying to get across with the Sudoku, is getting the log jams, getting things so out of kilter that we think we're meeting our targets, we think we're achieving our ends, but what in fact we're doing is we're completely missing. And I think we need to be able to say, well, actually, yeah, we can monitor through the system from production to consumption what we need to be doing, and we can match the two up adequately.
That's my question, Doctor.
Well, I think, unless anyone wants to come up with a question quickly, rather than prolong the agony, oh, come on then.
Did Russia use a higher percentage of its GDP for protection for its army expenditure than average of the world? Isn't this one reason for the slow growth of Russia as compared with market capitalist countries?
Right,
that have a similar real GDP.
Yes, that's an interesting question. I mean, yes, so you're asking, did Russia spend, or the Soviet Union spend more as a part of its share of its economy than its competitors? And certainly this model, this argument is put forward as one of the reasons why the Soviet Union collapsed. And it's also, it was beloved of the SWP, because they would argue that was part of its, why it was a state capitalist, because it was in competition with other capitalist nations. And so, again, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. I mean, that is the story, that Russia did spend very heavily on its military relative to other countries.
Relative
to its Western competitors, yes. But then partly, I mean, as Noam Chomsky points out, it was trying to compete with America when a more a better international comparator would be Brazil. The US and Russia were just nowhere near each other in economic terms, and Russia was trying to compete with America, whereas its economy was about the size of Brazil's, and that would have been, those two would have been much better to compare. And of course, Russia was demonstrating very interestingly that it could stay at the cutting edge of modern technology while still being a much, much smaller and poorer economy than the United States. But certainly, that wasn't the cause of the Soviet collapse, I don't think. I mean, there are some very interesting charts you can see online. Basically, the economy ground to a halt sometime around about 1973 and never recovered. One of the most interesting ones is deaths by alcohol, because alcohol consumption deaths grow in a steady graph, going quite steeply upwards towards 1989, that seems to indicate the underlying problem. What caused, I would argue, the Soviet collapse is similar to what happened to the Asian tiger economies, which was that Russia was growing not by intensive exploitation of capital, but by extensive exploitation of capital. So what it was doing was it was throwing resources into production, either technologies it found elsewhere or that it was able to develop fairly locally, and it was able, and natural resources, and it was able to grow that way. But when it came to the point of measuring the relative efficiency of its capital to improve the intensive exploitation of that capital. It just didn't have the mechanisms. So its planning mechanisms were okay for developing an economy and installing industrialization, but it couldn't compete and either politically, because it at least was disabled by its claim to be a workers' state, or just because it lacked the financial accounting capacity. So that makes it look like, and this is one of the reasons why a lot of the von Mises Institute jump around saying the economic calculation argument was proved right, because literally Russia could not measure its capital intensive use, it ground to a halt and fell apart. And also it became very subject to the oil shock of 1973. Anyone else?
I guess.
Hang on, sorry, there's someone. There's someone at the.
Market capitalism is due to. Army expenditure is unproductive anyway, and this causes lower growth. This is what I said.
Army expenditure is unproductive.
Yeah, I said the reverse of what the Socialist Workers' Party says. They say they keep capitalism by spending their external capital on army. I said the reverse. Russia grew is lower due to its army expenditure.
What Socialist Worker used to say was that because military expenditure is unproductive, Russia would not be subject to a capitalist crisis. It could resolve its crisis through what some of its members called the permanent arms economy. But they also did hold this line that it was international competition between Soviet capital and other capitals that made it a state capital. Their argument would vary from time to time in exactly what they were saying. And certainly, military expenditure is unproductive in itself, except in the research and development area, where the military tends to be, as we see in Egypt, the progressive force, because the military needs modern technology, and therefore it demands, okay, well, we need to have the latest tech to compete militarily in the world, and therefore we will make sure that we have modern industry and modern technology, and they do drive that forward. So that there was that element of producing ideas and producing new technology and driving that sort of thing forward. So,
yes, I take a sort of, I suppose, a simplistic view of how things could be done. We start with the point that you've got to have majority understanding of what's involved, and when you actually abolish capitalism, you don't abolish all knowledge of the experience of what's happened within the system. You don't lose all ability to weigh and measure and work out what will be needed. So I don't see it as a problem. Of course there'll be difficulties, but difficulties resolved free from the financial consideration. You've got to work, you mustn't be wasteful, as it were. You've got to work out the cost of the environment, resources, and so on. But it's a different way of looking at things. As I say, you won't lose all experience of what's happened before and how things could be done. And I feel that although there will be problems, I feel it's simpler.
Absolutely, I agree largely. Although, I mean, I'll give an example from my own experience, because what we were talking earlier before the recording started about disposing of books from libraries. So I'm a librarian, and my job is to buy the books. And of course, I have occasionally asked myself the question: well, how would we do this in socialism? Because obviously, we wouldn't want to have absolutely every book. We wouldn't have any budget, but we would then find ourselves up against resource limits of the amount of time we would have to process the books, get them on the shelves, store them. You know, we would have to come up with some way of saying, okay, how do we, other than just saying no, choose the books and come up with something. So it kind of appeals to me, the idea of just saying, look, you have a budget of 100% or some sort of market where you can go and treat it like a game. I think that's the thing. Go along a game, go, well, we'd like that one, please. And, you know, there'll be some negotiation over which books get produced, which don't, and these sort of things would go forward. alternatively, libraries might get abolished because there'd be no need for them anymore because people could just go to the publisher and get the book. But there would still be some need for some sort of bibliographic control, I think. But you're absolutely right, is in that we have the expertise and we're running the systems. And of course, that's, you could discuss with the Kantarovich thing, we could just take over pricing as we find it, turn it into shadow pricing and run an economy based on that for the next 10 years. No one actually has to hand over any cash, but you've still got all the financial, a lot of the financial controls until you can work out a way to wean yourself off them. Clearly, part of the point is not necessarily that, you know, like I say, that we need to come up with now a plan for how socialism can work. What we need is a refutation to an argument and suggestions for that say it is possible, so can we move back to the argument, not is it possible, isn't it, but should we do it, shouldn't we? And I think that's kind of the underlying theme of what I was trying to get across today. Yes, Adam.
Von Mises, his original criticism of socialism, conceded that it's easy or it's possible to calculate what was needed. And his problem is that you can't calculate how best to produce that. But his followers today, you won't even concede that it's possible to calculate what's needed. In fact, they criticize him for making that concession to us. But of course, it's right, it's true, it is, yes. As Pat just said, but it's not wrong to calculate what's needed. That's straightforward. And as to how to produce it, well, things are not more, there's an absolute abundance, but things are more abundant than they were in state capitalist Russia. So, as you said before, we don't necessarily have to use what would be the most efficient way of doing it, our capitalist standards model. So, I don't see the economic calculation argument, so-called, as being an argument against socialism.
I agree absolutely, and it's. He also made other concessions. I mean, I know the one that we, as the party, use quite frequently is, he said, well, of course, if there's abundance, then this doesn't apply. So that's obviously the first one. But of course, that then invites the response from the libertarian kid in the States. Well, where's my own personal Death Star then? You know, and then that's why, because they argue, abundance only means that supply meets demand. It doesn't mean an infinite supply or a cornucopia of goods. It just means that what people are actually asking for can be made available, and no one is actually asking for a Death Star. Well, I've put in my request, but Father Christmas won't listen. But also, he also envisages, more or less what I was saying just now, is that he concedes the possibility of, if there was a very smooth transition, that it would be possible to go over using some sort of shadow pricing for the long term. But he says, well, obviously that can't happen because it's far too chaotic and there'll be a revolution going on. So I suppose one of our other counter-arguments is, well, we say we can have a smooth transition, which comes back to the argument on the forum about capturing control of the state at the moment. And these things forward. It's just interesting that sometimes, you know, you get ex-party members, I know there are a few out there who actually suddenly see the light and go, actually, oh yeah, he's right. And, you know, it's almost about, you know, people who have been convinced about the need for socialism in the first instance saying, well, actually, no, don't listen to this siren call of the economic calculation argument. And you don't have to read everything written by Robin Cox, you know, it's interesting to read that, but that's another possibility, what he puts forward with his law of the minimum and what have you. But there are refutations and we can take it forward. One thing I had been going to work in that I forgot to put in, I was going to read out the Socialist Economic Plan, which is it's one clause of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which just says everyone should have access to the things that they need. That's the plan. There, you see, it's almost one sentence. I think it's Article 6 or something like that. And after that, everything, you know, you don't have to have a Leontief input-output matrix. All it is one, when we talk about working to a common plan, is that we have this idea that we want to achieve definite ends for ourselves, to have this outcome for human needs, food, water, clothing, housing, and that we can do that. So yes, so the attempt on the other side to complicate the matter and make it sound much more difficult than it really is, it's clearly special pleading. But I think it's special pleaded that we do have to take seriously enough to turn around every now and again, or if we have some people who, as Morris says, like that sort of thing and have the hobby, to go, well, no, we've read our stuff, we're not talking out of ignorance, we have the answers, or potential answers, or enough of an answer to move on to another question.
Yeah, we've talked about before, it's another valid point that he's made, that we can continue when socialism is first established using the same methods as capitalism had immediately before, and then we adapt them. You don't have to start from scratch to make a completely theoretical plan about how the most efficient way to do things. Obviously, speed and something like that will be ruled out, but I mean, we could keep going for 10 years on that without doing anything, whether it was the most efficient or not. We probably could.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the modern supermarkets, I mean, this is one of the ones, one of the stump arguments. If you've got a Nectar card or an Oyster card, part of what that's about is it's about non-market allocation of goods, because what they look at there, it's not the price of the individual things you buy, it's the price of the basket. And that enables them to then say, OK, we can decouple the price of an individual good. Because if people are coming in for biscuits, and when they pick up biscuits, they pick up coffee. We can cut the price of biscuits. It doesn't bear any relation to its actual cost anymore, because people will buy through the coffee with it, and we'll make the profit on the coffee and this sort of thing. And that's so. Most shops, I've heard people in the shops saying, "Well, the computer says it's coming up to July, time to stock up and buy water." So that, because they've got the data, they've got this massive amount of market data. They know what we're buying year on year in, year out. They know what they need. Only very small amounts of variation. It could be done. So it's a question of then, I suppose, how do we start implementing changes and doing the disruptive work of ending poverty and initiating democratic control over all of this. But yes, it's possible. It's not the most stirring thing to take away from a meeting, but it's possible. It's not completely impossible. That's all you need to take forward. It's possible. I'll sell that on to Barack Obama or someone like that the next time. Right, well, I think that a bit of a short one this time, but thank you all very much for coming along. We're supposed to have a collection at some point, are we?
Yes.
And then there's Team Biscuits upstairs, where the fun and games can continue. So thank you very much for coming along.